Keep up to date with the latest WSL action and the biggest interviews.
You'd be delighted, Karen, if you just had Katie doing full on attack.
This is the best team I've seen in weeks. Get her up there.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig podcast stream on the OTB Sports app now.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
3 minutes past nine this morning, and I'm delighted to welcome Fintan Drury to the show, who's just written a book called Seesaw about leadership and his career in many different aspects of Irish life. It's particularly the sports aspect that we're focusing on this morning, Fintan. But good morning to you. How are you getting on?
I'm good. How are you, Ger?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. How's the book going for you?
Yeah, it's going all right. I was just talking to Tommy before you introduced me there and saying that, you know, it's a kind of niche book, Ger. It's not going to be of wide interest. And it's also, you know, when you hear people on a show like this who haven't watched or heard of Sex and the City, then you realize that it's going to appeal to a certain cohort, but not necessarily the younger generations.
I have heard of Roy Keane, though.
Who's he?
Makes a bit of a difference.
We're kind of talking the 1990 and 94 World Cups here, though, on.
Yeah, well, Roy Keane was at the 94 World Cup, Chair.
It's true, in fairness. So let's start with that, because the players' pool, I think, is this... certain people of a certain generation will be familiar with the term and how the term became something that the public was aware of. Like one of those phrases that, you know, during the boom we learned new words and during the bust we learned new words. But the players' pool was something that kind of became part of the public's consciousness. What was the players' pool and how did it come into being?
Well, the players' pool, first of all, was a concept that knocked around British football for quite some time. I mean, I'm a Manchester City fan, so I'm in pretty good form this morning. But when they won the FA Cup, I remember as a youngster becoming aware that the players had a pool for commercial work that was done ahead of an FA Cup final. But then many years later, when I found myself becoming involved in sports management for the first time, I was approached by Kevin Moran and Liam Brady to advise the Irish team on the commercial side of qualifying for the World Cup in 1990. And we set up a players' pool, which was focused exclusively on generating as much income as possible for all of the players as a collective, a full squad. And we also included some of the backroom members of the coaching staff, and physios, and the bagman Charlie O'Leary, I remember, was involved. And the idea was that the players formed this collective. We created a brand called the Players Pool. There was actually a logo developed, and we took that to the commercial market with a view to generating additional income for the players. And they were a phenomenal squad of players. They were all playing at most of them playing at the top level in England. But it does show you that back then in 1990, even though they were very well paid for players of their time, of their generation, they still needed to generate additional income. So we created this vehicle, if you like, to ensure that there was a commercial spin-off for the players as opposed to the association from their qualification for the World Cup in 1990. They had qualified for the World Cup, I beg your pardon, for the European Championships in 1988. They qualified for the World Cup in 1990 and again in 1994.
I think you've done yourself and the book a disservice in terms of saying that it's going to be of niche interest. It's actually really fascinating to listen to the story of that, and I'll get into that in way more details, but it should be of interest to anybody who's interested in rugby or also GAA, because you've kind of been involved in massive big moments, kind of hinge moments in those sports as well. So to go back to the players' pool, there's a brilliant comparison between Arnold O'Byrne of Opel and Charlie Haughey doing his lap of honour at the World Cup, which when you wrote it down, I was like, yeah, that actually, that rings true, because my recollection of being 10, 12, 14 watching the Republic of Ireland qualify for tournaments was that Arnold O'Byrne and Opal had played a central role in this. They were there with the green jersey and the Irish Wolfhound in his jersey going, we got the team, we drove the team to Germany, essentially. It was like, you know, advertising really worked for Opal, and Arnold O'Byrne in particular became a minor celebrity a la Maurice Pratt at the time. But the players weren't getting any of that cash.
No, it was all driven by the association, excuse the pun, and very successfully. But that's just the way things were done at that time. And the opportunity was, because the players were so well known as club players, and then they were carrying Ireland to the World Cup for the first time in 1990, there was clearly an opportunity to use the personalities to give effect to something very different. And, you know, it created a bit of a storm at the time, because the way in which we launched it was we undertook a photograph, did this by stealth at the end of a training session. One day, a certain people made sure that Jack Charlton had been moved away from the training pitches. And we very quickly assembled the squad in a standard squad photograph. And we got a pretty well-known sports photographer to take the photograph of the squad wearing T-shirts bearing the Irish Permanence logo. And they were just plain green T-shirts, so they weren't wearing the official Irish squad, Irish shirt. And we kept that under wraps until the team qualified, and then we launched it with 48 sheet posters once qualification had been secured. And the impact was dramatic, and the Irish Permanent became as well associated with the Irish squad, even though as Opal did over those 4 years between 1990 and 1994. And it was dramatic because it broke the notion that the only people who could sponsor the Irish football team, the only way people could do that, or commercial enterprises could do that, was through the association. We broke that assumed position, and it went to the steps of the High Court. Opal took a legal case against us, and the players supported us. The FAI remained kind of neutral on it because it wasn't actually legally their problem. And we won the day.
And obviously the players needed the money, and that was the driving force behind them. So they rallied him to make sure that you had the support when Opal came to the steps of the High Court.
Jerry, I think it was more than that. It wasn't just that they needed the money, or some of them needed the money more than others. But what they absolutely believed was that this was a matter of principle, and that it was important to set new boundaries for the future. And that served Irish footballers very well ever since.
It helps to modernise the FAI's relationship with the players as well, because now, obviously, the players get contracted to do a certain number of appearances for the sponsors, and they get compensation for that, as opposed to back in the day where they were expected to show up, we'll give you a bit of gear, and maybe there'll be an envelope with a few pounds in it, but there might not be.
Yeah, it was a point in time. It was a line in the sand. And in fairness to Arnold O'Byrne, that's how many people who were chief executives of large corporations that were sponsoring sports bodies or athletes behaved at that time. That's become much less pronounced now.
There's large sections in the book that deal with the relationship that Brian Kerr had with John Delaney and John Delaney's stewardship of the FAI. I'm conscious that there is an ongoing investigation from the ODCE, so I don't want to step on any of that, and I would urge everybody to go and read the book. But can we talk about Brian Kerr in particular, who was a client of yours, and his time at the FAI? It almost felt like when the changing of the guard happened at the FAI, that Kerr's time was doomed almost irrespective of what happened, even though he himself didn't end up giving his best performance or fully actualising his talents when he was the Ireland manager. Is that fair?
Look, I'm not evading the question. I'm not competent to really evaluate his performance as Ireland manager in terms of, you know, how the team played and the results, etc. And you can argue these things from both perspectives, or from either you, in terms of the relationship between Brian and the FAI. I think, as I said on the Pat Kenny show the other morning, the fundamental problem with what happened was that Brian was exited Irish football at a time when he had contributed massively with the technical development of the sport. He was the technical director as he became manager of the senior team. And when he finished as manager of the senior team, he didn't just finish as manager of the senior team. He was allowed to leave. And he was a prized asset of the association, and he should have been retained, and he could have been retained. But they exacerbated that problem because he was succeeded as technical director by Paddy Bonner, who brought a very significant amount of knowledge to the association. And within a number of years, he was exited. And he continues to this day working in a technical capacity with UEFA. And over all of those years, the intellectual capital of those two men, the football intellectual capital of those two men, was lost to the association. That was a grievous error, and has, in my opinion, done immense damage to the development of the sport here.
I see some
parallels. Now, they're both friends of mine. So, you know, spoiler alert, to use your term from earlier in the program, you know, people who wouldn't know that need to understand. I'm not giving, this is not an objective view, but it's a view that I think a lot of people would share.
Well, in that context, right, because reading the book now in parallel with what's going on with Stephen Kenny, it feels like Irish football is trapped in this constant cycle where we find people who are good, we put them in the position where they should be in, and there's always somebody somewhere spinning against them from within. It's like normal roles, normal jobs, you have to manage the stakeholders, but you frequently don't expect to be in trouble with your own people. That's the worst part. It's like, I don't know, is it a disease that's specific to Irish football, or is it a disease that's specific to Irish life?
I think the same problem manifests itself in football in England, in lots of different ways. There's lots of different examples. I would have hope for the future of the FAI. I think Jonathan Hill, whom I don't know, everybody speaks very highly of. I know people who work with him in the UK and speak highly of him. I know Roy Barrett personally for many years, and he's a good person with a good outlook for the future of the sport. And look, the fact that Paddy Bonner has been brought back in, albeit just as a non-executive director of the board, is a positive. And there are better structures in place. Probably more work needs to be done on that. But I would be hopeful that phenomenon, which you correctly identify, is going to be less of a problem going forward.
Notwithstanding the fact that you're friends with Brian, it's very honest of you then to include in the book an incident that happens on The Last Word, where he's under pressure. And is it with Matt Cooper, or was it with Eamon at that stage? Had Matt already?
No, it was Matt.
It was Matt, okay. And maybe you'd be better to tell us exactly what happened. What did happen?
Well, it was at that point of, you know, he was just under siege, Brian, in terms of the FAI was spinning against him. I don't think the football journalists, or most of the football journalists at that time, covered themselves in glory. Some of them have since acknowledged that. They were kind of taking the FAI line. The results were patchy at best. And it was all a bit of a struggle. And it was getting very kind of intense within our core group. So that was the late, great Noel O'Reilly, myself, Brian, Chris Hughton, who was Brian's coach, and Gerry Smith. And we were kind of meeting and talking through what was going on. We could see what was happening. Brian felt under phenomenal pressure. And I made a really poor decision for somebody who had a lot of experience in communications management, who was previously a broadcaster himself. And I went on to The Last Word with Matt Cooper, who's knowledgeable on football, and did an interview like the interview we're doing now. And in the midst of it, in trying to defend Brian, I said, I used a phrase like, you know, it's, but they're not even the greatest squad of players we've ever had, which was factually correct, but wasn't the wisest term to use, particularly when your client is exposed, because the FAI picked that line up and within an hour they were spinning like mad against me. And we were in a kind of guerrilla war at the time. So I gave them that opportunity to say, look, here's the agent for the manager of the team saying publicly that it's a crap group of players. That's not what I said, but that's what the spin was. The comparison I was making, of course, was between the squads of 1990 and 1994. But it was a really, really sloppy error. And I make the point in the book, because it has a sort of wider context in terms of the overall view I'm trying to give of leadership within the book. I just make the point that, you know, sometimes when you're too close to the action and when you feel every hurt that your client is feeling because you're very close to that person, you can make poor judgments. And I lacked the objectivity at that point in time to give Brian the quality advice that he should have got.
I guess if that comment was made today, Fintan, it maybe wouldn't have had such a difference for a number of different reasons. Like, why do you think commenting on the playing group not being the best playing group of all time had such an impact? Because I think managers, coaches of Irish teams have said that exact thing in the aftermath, let alone somebody working outside the camp with the Ireland manager.
Well, I mean, I was speaking with Dion Fanning about this relatively recently, and he was a football correspondents at the time. He would say that he would acknowledge that he didn't give it the kind of objectivity and treatment or the deep analysis, if you like, of what the FAI was doing. So I think, Owen, that really what was happening was, it wasn't what I said, it was just that it provided an opportunity to the association, which wanted to continue to undermine the position of its manager. I mean, bizarre behavior, but that's what was happening. I provided them with another line, another opportunity to go after the manager through me, if you like.
There's an amazing story where you talk about Brian showing up for, I don't know, is it a Sport Against Racism or is it a Gold Mile photo shoot where he wears the St. Patrick Athletic jersey and they have a telecom sponsor, but Aircom are actually the sponsor of the Republic of Ireland. And this is another stick that the FAI tried to beat him with. Unbeknownst to them, you were actually in contact with Aircom and saying, is this an issue? And they're saying, it's not an issue. So I think it's those type of details that will help to build a picture for anybody who wants to understand exactly what the FAI was like around that period of time. And it's a good campaign piece to Champagne Football. Everybody read that book last year, so I think anybody who is interested in learning a bit more about that should dig out to see. So can we talk about some of the other sporting organisations as well? The Johnny Sexton transfer, Johnny Sexton was a client of yours at that time, so you know exactly how that deal came to be made. And again, the great detail on it in the book. In retrospect, what's your view of that whole period of time?
Are you talking about, in the first instance, his move to France or move back from France?
Both really. Now, like at the remove, when you're sitting down writing the book, what are your emotions as you're going through that whole thing?
Well, Johnny's a man I respect a great deal. We're friends, I felt excited to represent him when I did. And he, you know, felt, I'm oversimplifying this, but he felt a little bit unloved by the IRFU at the time of the move to Racing Metro. And that was part of what made it happen. But ultimately, the reason he went to Racing was because the financial terms were phenomenal. And he became one of the highest paid players in the world. But also, he was really excited by the opportunity to work with coaches in a new club, in a different club, and play in his rugby, his club rugby in France. And I think one of the points that I try to make in the book about representing players, particularly professional footballers, but also rugby union players, is that a good agent, which I like to think I am, a good agent doesn't think about the money until other work has been done in advance. And that starts and started in that case with Johnny, with my going to Paris and meeting with the coaches and reviewing the setup and looking at where he might live and going through all of that kind of thorough assessment of the setup for him, what it would be like to live there and for him and Laura. So, you know, I spent a weekend over there meeting people, all the senior people in the club, and I came back and had, you know, prepared a written assessment. We sat down and went through it and discussed it a number of times before he then went over with me sort of maybe a fortnight or so later. And he was he spent a lot of time with the coaches, and essentially we came back and made a decision that if the IRFU didn't move the needle sufficiently, that he would go. And when I say we, I should correct myself. I have never ever told a player in any code, you know, where to go, what to make, decision to make. They've always made the decisions themselves as to what club to go to or to stay in a particular club. But in this particular case, you know, we went through it very, very thoroughly. And the view was that if the IRFU moved the needle significantly, but not up to the level that Racing was prepared to pay, that Johnny would stay. And it just didn't happen. And off he went. And, you know, it was pretty controversial at the time. I shipped a bit of criticism, but that's fine. You're just doing your job. Everything was done properly. 2 years later, he came back, and that's when our professional relationship ended. And one of the things I think I write about in the book is how he did that, and effectively how he fired me. And we were really close, but it was, I think, you guys who, you know, who cover sport all the time will understand this, and that he fired me the way he is on the pitch. You know, it was, he called me, he discussed it with me, but he was just very clear, very frank as to why. And I understood why. And that was it. There was no hesitation. It was like he is when he picks a ball up and there's somebody or maybe a clatter of players between him and the line, and he's going to get there.
It's brutal. It is brutal. You had kind of seen at first hand. So he rings Philip Brown himself to say, "I'm going." Like, he makes that call. He doesn't get you, even though that your job is to do all that stuff in the first place. So you're on the receiving end of that call the next time round.
Yeah, no, and actually that's a good point here that I should have made, because it does illustrate just the mettle of the man. Exactly that. When he made the decision that he was going to go to Paris, you know, he wanted to make the call himself. So he takes responsibility for his own actions and he was, you know, he was equally direct with me. And that was just the way it was. And I was hurt and upset on a number of different levels, because we were good friends. I'm glad to say we are again today and have been for quite some time.
Why did he fire you?
It was clear that it would be easier to get the deal done in the way in which the deal was going to be structured if I wasn't going to be involved. It wasn't that he had any less trust in my ability or that he had any doubts over my capacity to get the job done. I was still at that time in discussions with Racing because we were looking at and one other club in France because we were looking at the different options as his contract with Racing was coming to an end. So there were extraneous reasons as to why he understood that it would be easier to get the deal done without my being involved, and he accepted that as he was perfectly entitled to do, and he fired me. And look, it's also very important, you know, I often say to young players, I'm a phenomenally talented young player who I'm delighted to represent for the last 4 or 5 years, called Ethan Ampadu, Chelsea player, Welsh boy. And, you know, he's been at a number of clubs on loan, as football fans will know and understand. And you're constantly educating or helping young players to see that, you know, managers come and go, and even managers who have faith in them for a period of time may lose faith in them and may leave them out of the team or squad for a period of time. So you've got to help your players understand that, right? But you've got to understand it about yourself as well. You know, that you could be fired, that you could be left out, that somebody can lose, you know, interest in being represented by you. So you have to accept that when it happens.
One final thing I wanted to talk about in the time we have left was the praise for Pádraig Duffy is as high praise as I've seen compared to anybody else in the book, almost, as the quality of an administrator and somebody who was good to deal with over a period of time. Because you were an advisor to the GPA when they were doing the deal, the first deal that brought them inside the tent of the relationship they have now with the GAA. What was it about Pádraig Duffy that was so singular in terms of how he stood out for you?
Two quick things, Ger. First of all, that was, to me, it's one of the proudest things I was involved in 30 years working in professional sport. To work with Donal Logan and Desi Farrell on getting that deal done was a really proud moment. Look, Pádraig Duffy, the best and most succinct way I can put this is when the FAI got itself into dire trouble years ago, and I was trying to use some influence in certain quarters, and I said, get Pádraig Duffy had, it's not that long ago, because Pádraig had only just retired as head of the GAA, and I said, get that man in there and get him in fast, get him into Abbottstown and get him to sort it out. That's that, like, and football is my sport. I love most sports, but football is my sport, and it upsets me what happened within the FAI. There was the man to sort it out. He was quite, he is an exceptionally talented administrator. And the GAA has benefited enormously from his time with his hand on the tiller.
Look, what sets him apart? Because that's really interesting. I haven't heard anybody say that before, Fintan. What sets him apart from other administrators?
Very, first of all, very capable, just bright man, very understated, very, very calm, and direct and honest. You know, those are like, they may not seem like massively, that might not seem like a very strong endorsement, Owen, because they're such basic characteristics. But in fact, in my experience in professional sport, it's those basic characteristics that are the real riches that are often missing. And I found him to be exceptionally good to deal with.
You're a football agent mainly now, or do you still represent people in other sports? Have you kind of just focused exclusively on football at this stage?
Yeah, just football, yeah.
and that's just the right thing to do. The rugby ended up being more of a pain.
Well, ultimately, you're in business to make a return, and if the scale of professional football is such that the numbers, we know this, the numbers are just very much greater than what you're dealing with for doing the same job in rugby union.
That makes sense. Fintan, I wish you the very best of luck with the book. I genuinely say people can read it in a couple of hours, and we haven't even touched on Anglo or Paddy Power or Brian Cowan, which are also huge pillars in the book. So it's a remarkable achievement to get it all down and tie the strands together of a career that is a bit like Forrest Gump, like front row seats for some massive, massive moments in history.
Forrest Gump.
I mean that in the nicest possible way, by the way.
Thanks for that, Ger. You might have to explain to all your listeners who never heard of Sex and the City who Forrest Gump is, by the way.
Best of luck with the book, Fintan. Thanks a million for joining
us. Cheers. Thanks very much, Owen. Thank you, Ger.
It's called Seesaw, and it's available wherever you can get the books. But, like, honestly, you'll read the sports section in a couple of hours and go, oh, right, wow, that was a big moment. That's another big moment. Mm. That's another big moment. And it's the three main sports, and you get to very clearly compare and contrast how well or otherwise the sports are administered, and you get to
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.